This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. It's where we call on reporters here in Northwest Indiana to join us to talk about the stories that they've offered up in print and as well as online. And today we have Carol Carlson and Greg Tejeda from the Post Tribune. And we have Northwest Indiana Times business reporter Joseph Pete joining us a little later to talk about the stories that they have offered up. And we'll also bring back our conversation with Brendan Clifton, who's the Chief of Staff for the Indiana Secretary of State's office. That and more coming up, but first, the news. This is Regionally Speaking, Reporter Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's check in here with Greg Tejeda. He's a reporter, covers mostly news around Gary for the Post Tribune. And Greg, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, let's get started here talking about, the latest effort. Now that we've had the list of properties that the city of Gary wants to sell off, one of them we know is the Genesis Convention Center. And I guess it's still kind of up for grabs if anybody wants it, but there was, I guess, a company that was very interested, maybe still is, about it. Tell us about that.
There's a company that's out of Cleveland, based out of the suburbs of Cleveland. It's been doing some work on an unrelated project for Gary. They have interest in taking over ownership of the Genesis Center. They've got their own vision of how it could be remodeled, made more of a modern facility, and it could be something profitable. The problem, however, is back a month ago when the Genesis Center was formally placed up for bid, there was a, I don't know if you call it a paperwork screw-up or what, they failed to get in a bid. They missed the deadline, which is why officially nobody placed a bid for the Genesis Center. So now there's a period they had to wait at least 30 days before they could do anything. And now Gary Redevelopment Commission officials are of the legal opinion that now they can just openly negotiate with anyone who comes to them and expresses interest. So there's at least this one buyer that is expressing some interest. And they're hoping that eventually they'll have somebody willing to come forth and place a bid. Someone other than Gary resident Jim Nowacki, the often outspoken critic of the city, who did once go to the Redevelopment Commission and told me he'd bid $100 for the property.
$100? Wow.
He says that's all it's worth in its current condition.
He
offered to take it off their hands.
For $100.
The city, of course, refused to accept that and mocked him and ridiculed him for it.
He's just lucky to get laughed out of City Hall for that.
Oh, they laugh him out of City Hall every day.
Okay.
But it doesn't stop him from coming.
Of course not. One of the other stories, too, that you had out recently in print as well as online in the Post Tribune was one that involved City Councilwoman Reagan Hatcher, and it also deals with property. Tell us about that.
She wants to buy a home. She lives in the Miller Beach section of Gary, and it turns out there's a house two blocks away from her that she's always admired, and it's really a process. The bank turned it over to the city. The city's looking to unload it, and as a result, it came up for auction at the same time as the Genesis Center, and Reagan Hatcher turned out to be the lone person who placed a bid for it. $65,001 she bid. She had based her bid off some estimates that it would probably take about $65,000 to get the property. And then she added the dollars to make sure she didn't get outbid. And then when she found out she was the lone bidder, she had her own personal property assessment done. And they're estimating that it's probably only worth about $25,000. So now she's asking the Redevelopment Commission to formally reject her bid that she placed. And she's going to she wants to negotiate with them a more reasonable price.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the house is one. It was in foreclosure. It's been empty for a few years. There was actually some fire damage. So it's one of these properties. She's going to have to put money in it to make it livable again. But it is, my understanding, it has the potential to be a very nice house for the future state representative from the area.
Do you get the impression that she wants to be a landlord in this case? She's not going to live in it herself, but she wants to take it on as just an additional income property?
She's actually claiming she likes the house for herself.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that's fine.
Yeah. Now, whether or not it means her old house is one she would hang on to as a rental property, that's always possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got to take her on her word when she says she likes the home. You know, I don't have enough fact to be able to say the future representative is a liar. So,
well, and we know that for, you know, if she's interested and she has the funds set aside and she wants to take the chance of not running into problems when she gets into that property, like you say, because it's been abandoned or left vacant at least, and it's had fire damage. So who knows what other problems might be inside the house? And she won't know that, and of course, until she gets the contractors in there checking it out. But
right.
She may be surprised that maybe a real gem after all, if she's had her eye on it for all this time, to be sure. So interesting. I understand, too, one of the other stories that you had out recently also deals with more property. In this case here, about a proposed development project in Gary called Broadway Lofts. Tell us more about that and how a company out of the Queen City, Cincinnati, is interested in it.
They're working on the project, which is supposed to help upgrade a neighborhood. And they, as part of their vision, see a bunch of other properties scattered around Gary they want to purchase. And they put in their own bid, $8,500 for 41 plots of land, mm-hmm. all of which are currently vacant lots. Now, it also turns out they were the only bidder, so it's very likely that later this month they're going to be awarded it. They're going to get it. Now, remember how I said earlier that Jim Nowacki placed his bid of $100 for a piece of downtown Gary land?
Yeah.
Well, that $8,500, if you break it down, is $207 per plot of land. That is what they're bidding.
Well, maybe Jim Nowacki's bid. Maybe Jim Nowacki's bid's not out of the realm of possibility. Maybe he is right that about $100 per lot. Who knows?
Anyway, this company has put in their bid. They're hoping later this month to formally learn that they're going to get the land. Because right now, attorneys are reviewing the bid, which is the lone bid. Nobody else offered up anything for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where that stands. Now, how these plots of land fit in with the Broadway lots, if this would make it bigger, or if this is, they've got maybe similar projects in mind for that land, that's still up in the air. The company's still, they're trying to guarantee they get the land before they start planning what to do with it. But their experience working in Gary thus far has made them interested in more Gary real estate. So we'll have to take it easy and see what comes of this.
Oh. Well, we'll find out. Stay tuned to that one, I guess, too. We're talking with Greg Tejeda, who covers news in the city of Gary for the Post Tribune. And Greg, I understand you have a couple other stories that are due out if they haven't already been put out on the website. Tell us about those, please.
In the city of Gary, there was an interesting conversation before their planning committee earlier this week on the concept of daycare centers. Two women approached the council this week with their own ideas. They want to open up daycares in their home, even though in their respective neighborhoods, that would make them like the third or fourth daycare on the block. And that actually has, and thus far, Gary this year has issued special permits to allow for more than a dozen daycare centers. Now, they only rejected one plan that was put forth. And it has some city officials wondering, are we getting overloaded with daycare? And it turned into this whole discussion because technically the city planning and zoning officials are saying they don't have the legal authority to reject these things. They've got certain criteria that they review when somebody asks for a rezoning of a land. And whether or not what it would use for like that isn't technically within their realm. Technically, the state of Indiana regulates daycare centers.
Right.
And the state of Indiana is only concerned whether or not any particular proposal would provide safety for the children who were there. So you got this back and forth. Nobody seems really sure who has the authority to do anything. And Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson indicates that there are some talks taking place at a higher level that could have the state coming in to give municipalities some authority to intervene. And that seems to have the ultimate the council members thinking at this point that something could happen in the near future that they could be getting some authority to start controlling more strictly how many people come in wanting to take care of a dozen or so kids in their home, which is what a lot of these little daycares amount to, usually about their capacity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose this goes along with the concept of home rule. And we know that that's been the big push for decades in Indiana, is to be able to secede enough authority over from the state to the localities, the towns and cities, and decide on these issues. So I suppose if they have to take up these issues for the proper use of property in their communities, that I guess whether their daycare center is okay or not, I guess it's a good one too. So that's
right. I know the mayor said she's urging city officials just to be patient, that this will get dealt with in due time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I know that you're working on another story, too. If you will, fill us in on that, please.
Wednesday night, the Gary Redevelopment Commission amended the deal it approved 2 years ago with Myoco LLC, which is a firm in Gary connected to a firm in Chicago that is run by former Mayor Richard M. Daley. It is a company that wants to come in and advise Gary on how they can take all their scattered plots of abandoned land and incorporate them with a lot of the plots that currently taxes are delinquent and they're eventually going to have to claim, and eventually turn all these large plots, large tracts of land that the city could then turn and start appealing to these large companies. We've got a huge chunk of land here. Come build here. Come to us. Anyway, what's happened is this deal was negotiated back in July of 2016. Last night it got amended. The concept, technically, the company, instead of being Myoco LLC, is now Myoco Properties. And it's being restructured and slid away, I'm told. It's going to try to encourage more people to want to invest their money in it. But also in the change of this agreement, there's going to be more reporting requirements. Technically, Myoco officials are supposed to be making annual reports to the city as far as their progress is concerned. That's going to become every 90 days now. And technically, there's also various goals that Myoco, in their original agreement, claimed they would make at the 5-year mark, the 10-year mark, the 20-year mark of their existence, because it's a 30-year contract they have with them. Now it's going to be it's annual goals. You know, they're supposed to show they've made progress every year toward their eventual goal of coming up with large tracts of land to actually attract business to Gary. I've got Myoco officials claiming that this isn't as exciting as some people might want to make it out to be. It's basically the same company is how they're trying to downplay this. But they're also admitting this could be move toward bringing in more investors, making this company stronger. So it's something that got dealt with last night. It's going to move forward. And we'll see what happens, because there are some people out there who, the moment you bring up Myoco, it'll set them off. The idea that any changes were made in the Myoco agreement, they'll be looking for the conspiracy theory.
Right.
So we'll have to see just how much of that turns out to be true.
Well, I'm sure that one of them is probably, those people would be concerned, is going to be Jim Nowacki, because he's complained about it before, as I recall.
Well, for what it's worth, after last night's meeting, he was there at that meeting. He confronted the Myoco people, started questioning them rather intently. So we'll see what happens how much of an issue he continues to make of this.
Great.
And there are other people in Gary, too, who will become outspoken at this whole idea. Yeah. Myoco is not a popular name. And it's even worse because it gets confused often with that other company, Maya, that...
The energy company that that wants to do the solid waste processing facility across from the Seal City Academy in Gary too. So another very similar name and very similar controversy that's developed there too.
It'd be a lot of screaming in Gary when it comes to people.
That's for sure. Greg Tejeda, cover stories from the city of Gary for the Post Tribune, and as always, Greg, thank you very much for the updates, and certainly on the new stories that are coming out. We'll look to them as well too, and thanks much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We're switching now from Gary City Hall to Gary Community School Corporation, and for that we are turning to Carol Carlson, who is a reporter for the Post Tribune, who covers a lot of the news stories involving the Gary Community Schools. Carol, thanks for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Let's start out talking about, about how important it is, if you're a school superintendent, that you have to be sort of a jack of all trades. Besides being an educator, you have to be a skilled promoter. And obviously, Dr. Peggy Hinckley, in her past life as a school superintendent, before she got to becoming an emergency manager, had a chance, I'm sure, to do a lot of promoting. And she is in that role right now with the Gary Community School Corporation, in a way, helping to get people to bring their youngsters back to Gary schools. Tell us about what the promotional ideas that they have to try to get parents to get their youngsters back in class.
Well, they're doing a number of things. Of course, like everyone else, they're establishing a strong social media presence. They're sending out flyers to all the homes in the city, and they are doing robocalls to parents in an effort to let them know about registration and when the first day of school is. They're also making some major strides in improving their athletic programs that they hope will interest parents and stimulate more enrollment, which is, you know, key to their financial stability.
I know your story in the Post Tribune talks in particular about how many people have youngsters that are in the city of Gary, and how many of them are, I guess, attending not only the Gary Community Schools, but all of the other charter schools and other private schools around the community. Give us an idea of how many youngsters there are and where they are going to school.
They've got quite a lot of kids that live in Gary but don't necessarily go to the Gary Community Schools. They've got about 4,700 students last year.
Mm-hmm.
In charter schools, there were about 5,500. And then you've got about another 1,800 either in privately supported schools with vouchers or in other neighboring school districts.
I suppose it might be parochial schools as well, too, I would imagine.
Correct.
Yeah. All right. When looking up ways to be able to attract students to come back into the Gary Community School Corporation, I know Dr. Hinckley has had to talk with a lot of people, and I understand that she's probably had to enlist some help from the Gary Teachers Union at some point along the state.
Yeah, they had talks with the Teachers Union because the elementary school day was just 6 hours, which was probably, I don't know for a fact, but I would guess it would be the lowest or one of the lowest in Northwest Indiana. They extended that day, I think it was 6 hours and 15 minutes. They've extended it to 6 hours and 45 minutes once they got agreement with the teachers union.
I was also noting, too, that in your story you mentioned about the fact that, which has already been announced, it's not anything really new, but the fact that the Gary Community School Corporation is relocating its central administration center from a former elementary school on Polk Street, which is just a few blocks to the west of Broadway, and they're moving over all the way over to the west side of the city.
Right. They are currently in an existing school building. It was called the Lincoln Achievement Center. That building was closed back in 2014, and the administration at that time decided to close the former administration center, which was on 10th Place, and relocate to this Lincoln School. And now the Lincoln School is actually up for sale, one of 33 schools that's being sold, and the school administration is going to move into a wing at Westside, mm-hmm. on the west, sort of the northwest portion of the building there.
I know in some of your previous stories in the Post Tribune, talking about the Gary Community School Corporation and the changes that are being made, we of course know about the fact that the school in Miller's closed, the high school shifting over to Westside this year. Also, the middle school concept is coming back in. Tell us about the changes that are made there, and in turn, what some of the plans are for curriculum at what was known as the Banneker Achievement Center.
Yeah, Gary school officials are pretty gung-ho on this new middle school concept. They moved the elementary portion of the Banneker Achievement Center over to fold it inside of Marquette Elementary, which is probably less than a mile away,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to open what they're calling the Gary Middle School at the old Banneker site. And originally, this school was built to be a middle school. It was called Kennedy King Middle School at the time, and it's configured to be a middle school, and it's an ideal location that's already set up for that. So that's what they're doing, and and they are going into the STEAM program, which is science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics, and they're excited about it, and they think that that'll be one more thing that will bring enrollment back.
That's good. That's good. And I know that we've talked before in previous conversations here about all the changes that are happening with the shift of in high school, shifting over to Westside High School. And I guess that they have really, really big plans for making sure that students get a good educational experience and a good sports experience, too. Fill us in on what's planned for Westside starting this year.
Well, Westside is going to be part of a new athletic conference. They haven't been in a conference in a few years, and they're going to be joining the Great Lakes Athletic Conference, which has all the Hammond schools and East Chicago Central. So they're excited about that, and they're hoping to have up to 1,200 students at Westside this year. That includes all the Ward Emerson students that they're hoping will move over to Westside, where they're creating a similar visual and performing arts program that they had at the Wirt Emerson location. And Mark Spencer, who's a pretty renowned arts educator in Gary, is going to be heading up the visual and performing arts program there.
Wow, good. That's good. We don't. And speaking of visual performing arts, of course, it's shifted over to Westside from the fact that Ward Emerson has closed in the Miller neighborhood. And one of the other stories that you had out there in the Post Tribune online and in print talks about the great art collection that's at the school, and it's up for auction. And is there anything new that you know of on the bidding on how the process is coming along?
The bids are going along well. I just found out that there is an extension of the auction for another month.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some concern over the bust of William A. Wirt and the fact that some people think that it shouldn't be sold. It should be part of Gary's history. It is part of Gary's history, they say, and it should be put in some kind of a museum or perhaps as a library or something like that. But that bust is drawing the most attention on the auction. It's up to about $6,600 right now.
I'm taking a look at the information that's come in from the auction company about that, and that's that seems to be the highest bid
yeah.
of all of them. I guess they have some that haven't gotten bids yet, but they have had some others too. I guess a much smaller version of Rodin's The Thinker has gone for $25. Somebody's interested in that, and we know that there's some other great pieces of art too, like and one in particular that. Some folks here at the station have their eye on is a 1966 Northwest Indiana history wall sculpture. Now, it's not got a lot of bids on it right now, but it's something interesting. There are a lot of really interesting pieces of art that have been over at Ward Emerson School. It looks like that I'm sure that somebody will take advantage of it, and I'm sure that some of it they, as like you say, in this case in particular with the bust of William Wirt, they ought to hang on to that.
Yeah, of course, he was Gary's first school superintendent, but it was much more than that. He put Gary on the map, basically. He started some education programs that became nationwide models. They called the work-study play system. And school districts from across the country came to Gary to learn about what Wirt was doing with this large immigrant student population whose parents came to work in the mill.
That's interesting. We've talked here about bidding and such, about this case here, about the arts, art materials that are on display, have been on display over at Ward Emerson. Let's talk about the latest, if you have it, on the bidding for the buildings. There are a number of buildings, 33, I guess, if my counts and your counts,
yeah.
Right, is that are basically up for bid to anybody that's interested in taking over a closed-up Gary School building.
Yeah, and the first round of bidding was intended just for local taxing units for public universities. So that pretty much narrows the scope quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just had one bid, and that was from the city of Gary, $100,000 for Franklin Elementary School. The city is hoping to win a $30 million federal grant to build housing on the site, similar to what they have in Miller, in the Duneland Street, as well as the Horace Mann Hope 6 programs off of, I think it's Washington Street.
I know that some of the school board members and the attorney members, and as well as I know one of the attorneys in the community, Mr. Lay, is a little concerned that some asking prices are just a little too high. And he mentions one building in particular. Although I think about it, it's probably one of the best kept buildings as far as maintenance is concerned. We're talking about Dunbar Pulaski Middle School on 19th Avenue.
Well, probably I don't think you'd get much argument if you said all of the asking prices were too high. Peggy Hinckley, the emergency manager, said those prices were based on the assessed valuations they received from the Calumet Township assessor, and they're certainly not set in stone, and I doubt that any offer would be rejected unless it was ridiculously low, but they are willing to bargain with you, and the public bidding will commence next week. So that will be the interesting round. We'll see what kind of interest is out there among the bidding public and possible commercial development of some of these things.
Well, then it means that we're going to have opportunities to find out more interesting bids over a time, and the more organizations get involved, and starting any organizations outside of city government in Gary on some of the property that's up there. Carol Carlson is a reporter for the Post Tribune, and she covers news on the education scene in the city of Gary. And we thank you, as always, for being with us and bringing us up to date on these things, even about the artwork at Ward Emerson High School. We appreciate that, too.
Thank you, Chris.
This is Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio's Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte, and it's time now to take a look at business news around Northwest Indiana. And, of course, for that, we are turning to Joseph Peet, who's the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Joseph, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Chris.
Let's take a look at the steel industry first here. One of the stories that you have out there, it's online and it's in print as well, too, takes a look at on a national basis about the impact of, I guess, the tariffs that are being put into effect on foreign-made steel and how it is affecting the supply chain of that steel that makes its way to factories and in turn to businesses that use it. Bring us an update on what the American Institute for International Steel had to say.
Oh yes. Well, some of the tariffs have been in response to the steel crisis over the last few years, where we've had elevated levels of like imports, which we basically had since like the early 2000s, and you know it resulted in close to 13,000 layoffs nationwide, multiple mill idlings, including East Chicago Tin for a while here. It's back online now, but these imports have taken a real toll on the American steel industry. And there even before these Section 232 tariffs, we did have nearly 200 tariffs on imported steel, including on from more than 33 countries nationwide. And then the current administration, of course, imposed the Section 232 tariffs of 25% on steel from everywhere in the world, including from some of our traditional trade partners like Canada and Mexico, where we have an interconnected auto industry. But some of the consumers of steel are obviously not very happy about this because it raises prices for them. The price of steel in the United States, it had been like as low as like I think around $450 for hot band a couple years ago, and now it's up to $900. It had peaked at around $1,000 a ton, but it's kind of fallen off a little bit to $900. But they're not happy with higher prices and higher prices for imports. And the American Institute for International Steel, which represents a lot of the buyers and users of steel, people like the ports and transportation, railroads, and so forth. They're not thrilled about the prices, which they say have hurt a lot of their business, and so they filed a lawsuit attempting to block the tariffs, arguing that it's not constitutional, that the Congress, when they passed the Section 232 law, ceded too much power to the president, and that they didn't allow for enough congressional oversight, and that it's hard to say if there's any merit to the lawsuit, if it's going to, or how much it's going to succeed, but they recently appealed to their members or soliciting donations of anything people could put forward to help pay for it. so you know they're a trade association. They're not like the most well funded, but they're trying to you know fight this tooth and nail. Like some of the companies, like Ford, blamed part of the, they had a, their profits fell to like $1.2 billion last quarter, like nearly in half, and they blamed it. It was largely because of like a slowdown in business in China, but they're also saying they're paying like $300 million more a quarter in you know steel, which adds up because automakers obviously use a lot of. Use a lot of steel, so a lot of the customers aren't, you know, thrilled about this, and there is this legal challenge. It remains to be seen if it will actually get anywhere in the court system.
Joe, I know also too when talking about steel, we have the concern about the impact of the tariffs, maybe on of course on foreign steel, but it's affecting us here in the country as well. We have talks that are underway on another contract between U.S. Steel and the United Steelworkers Union. We know of Northwest Indiana residents and their families very very interested in how the talks are coming along. What's the latest that you've heard in the discussions, and what have they seemed to have focused on up to this point?
Yes. Well, there. This affects thousands and thousands of steelworkers in Northwest Indiana, their families, and it really affects all of us because you know their income goes directly to you know local businesses and has a ripple effect. It's it kind of ends up affecting the entire community. Last time they negotiated new contracts was back in 2015. It was pretty grim days for the steel industry. Like East Chicago Tin was idled. A lot of plants were idled. That Granite City Mill that just restarted in down in the St. Louis area, that was like taken offline. Two of the blast furnaces were down. There were pink slips like nationwide for steel and aluminum workers. It was just these companies were losing tons and tons of money. In 2015, I believe ArcelorMittal lost $8 billion and U.S. Steel lost $1.5 billion. It was just very difficult conditions for the steel industry to be operating in. This time, it's kind of, you know, the steel industry has rebounded. They're in a much stronger place. They just reported profits yesterday. U.S. Steel went up from $18 million profit in the first quarter to more than $214 million in the second. ArcelorMittal made, I think it was like $1.5 billion, but they're both did, you know, really good. They're both making money now. They're benefiting from these tariffs and these higher prices and less of the foreign competition. So they're kind of in a position of financial strength, and the union is going to them and saying, well, now that you're doing better, we kind of want to share in it. The union, they didn't necessarily make that many concessions last time, but they were definitely playing defense. They had to fight off the efforts to strip their you know, strip away benefits and so forth. And then that's kind of what they're facing this time, even though conditions are better, especially with ArcelorMittal. ArcelorMittal has came out of the gate and demanded multiple concessions, saying they've been losing money in the United States and they need to be more competitive with other integrated steelmakers and mini mills. They're asking them to pay as much as like $8,000 a year in out-of-pocket costs for the so-called consumer-driven healthcare plan. And they're looking at slashing a number of benefits, including incentive pay, vacation pay, family and medical leave, career development funding, and you know, making multiple changes to severance, unemployment policies, sickness and accident policies. They're talking about doubling the monthly health care contributions for retirees, eliminating a $10,000 pension equity plan for the former ISG, International Steel Group employees, and then you know, forcing employees to pay $200 a month premiums for their for a worse health insurance plan than what they already have, or that $8,000 a year in out-of-pocket cost plan, which would be a substantial, you know, reduction in, you know, net income. So basically the union's kind of on the defensive here. They're trying to, defend and preserve the benefits they already have. Things don't seem as confrontational in the U.S. steel negotiations so far. They've mostly been discussing, like, local issues at the local mills. And so they said they've made a varying amount of progress depending on which mill and where it's located, but they're getting into where they're starting to discuss the national issues. But from what the union has been saying, the companies traditionally don't comment that much on, you know, what they're asking for in these ongoing negotiations until it's like complete. You know, they'll say stock things like, oh, well, we need to be competitive and we need, you know, this or that. But from what the union has been saying, basically, ArcelorMittal seems to be taking a bit of a harder line than U.S. Steel currently. But in both cases, you know, the workers didn't get any pay raises last time. They've gone 3 years without any pay raises. And these steel companies, like a lot of employers nationwide, are trying to, you know, strip health insurance benefits and just pass more costs on to their workers instead of shouldering that themselves, as they traditionally have.
I know that you mentioned one of your stories too about the fact that even though that the United Steelworkers Union members didn't get any raises, they were at least holding on to the benefits that they are. But maybe they don't have the paycheck any to pay the grocery bills as much. But at least you know that they still will have the benefits that will help get them to the doctor or to the hospital if they need to go there.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, but that's the big uphill battle because, like ArcelorMittal, 3 years ago, they switched their non-union employees to the plan with more out-of-pocket costs. Mm-hmm. And I've heard a lot of grumbling about that. Like, it's basically, they don't have that union representation to preserve that. But they're, they have, like, worse health insurance than what they did. They're paying more out-of-pocket for it. And the one of the big priorities for historically, like, the union secured a lot of gains early on, and then, you know, since then it's been a matter of, like, preserving the benefits that they do have. But there's also, like, push for more profit sharing and so forth. It's been a kind of a contentious issue, especially with ArcelorMittal over the past, because they implemented auto sharing or profit sharing in the way, like, Ford did, and those Ford workers get, like, you know, it's been a pretty good, like, past decade for the auto industry, and those auto workers have been taking home, like, checks of, like, locally of, like, several thousand dollars, like $8,000, $6,000, like that kind of thing, depending on how the year goes. Mm-hmm. And it's a, you know, substantial windfall. And ArcelorMittal passed, like, a similar, like, profit-sharing thing. The companies really like that because it's in lieu of raises, because that way when things are doing well, you know, everybody shares in the proceeds, but when things are doing poorly, they're not saddled with, like, higher labor costs. But see, the way the ArcelorMittal one has been structured, they haven't really been getting, the workers haven't been getting any profit sharing bonuses at all. They do get bonuses based on the price of steel, and so they have been seeing, you know, some bonuses based on the price of steel, but the profit sharing that they were supposed to get hasn't really materialized because ArcelorMittal is saying it's not been really turning much of a profit in the U.S. It's been, you know, it's profitable, hugely profitable internationally, to where they made like $1.5 billion in the last quarter. That's like on pace for like a $6 billion, like, annual profit, which is pretty good. But they're saying that, you know, their U.S. operations aren't profitable and that there's nothing to share. And so what that's benchmarked to in the future could be, you know, some of the discussion, because a lot of the members have not been happy that, you know, they're seeing quarter in and quarter out that the company's making a big profit and they're not really getting anything from it.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana Times business reporter Joseph Pete, and a couple of the other stories that we wanted to check on and see if there are any updates on were a couple of national businesses that have a great local impact. Lear Corporation is one, and the other is BP. We're talking about the Whiting Refinery, and both good news, I guess, from both companies. Tell us first here more about Lear Corporation, and of course, they're in the big construction plans right now in the Hammond area, aren't they?
Yes, Lear is currently building a new. They've been in. They make seats for Ford's Chicago assembly plant in Chicago. Just across the border and hit the Hagwish neighborhood. And they've long been in Hammond. They kind of outgrew that and added a second operation over in Portage, mm-hmm. where they did the subseat assemblies, but they've kind of outgrown that too, just because of all the demand for the Ford Explorer and so on in recent years. And so now they are building a new plant to consolidate their operations in Hammond again. They're building it across from the South Shore line in East Chicago. It is in Hammond. It's across it's like right on the border there, but it's just south of the South Shore Line station, and they're going to house nearly like 900 employees in there. It's not really a net gain of any employees, but making a huge capital investment of that size, you know, does guarantee that, you know, they're going to have like a long-term future in Hammond and Northwest Indiana, which is good because they're very, most of those jobs are very well paying. Some of the sub-assembly ones, there's been some issue with the pay before during previous contract negotiations. But generally speaking, those are pretty good jobs with good good benefits. And, you know, it is a cyclical industry, so they do, you know, they have done, you know, layoffs at times as demand, like, decreases. But, you know, that's apt to happen with almost any type of manufacturing. But anyway, the Lear is doing extremely well right now. They posted record profits in the second quarter. They made $331 million in profit, which is up from 6% from last year, and they're pulling in like $5.6 billion in revenue. They also do e-systems, which is like half of the company, but a large part of that is the seating, like the seats they make in Hammond, mm-hmm. and that business has been doing like very well. And they're just in a pretty good position right now. The auto sales have been kind of cooling in recent years a little bit, but they've, as a supplier, they're just the sales are still strong enough and kind of at near record levels that they're seeing strong sales and business.
Well, it seems like, too, that since they do a lot of sales and business with Ford Motor Company, of course, because of the Chicago assembly plant, that Ford is luckily one of the automakers that is still doing very well in selling SUVs and related vehicles here and pickup trucks, I guess, too. So I guess that the Lear Corporation gets to share in that opportunity to get more business, too, I would think.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Ford has been struggling a little bit. Like, it's particularly in China has been their big issue. Their profits fell quite a bit, but and a lot of Wall Street is not very optimistic about their long-term prospects. Their stock has kind of been sort of in the doldrums for a long while. People are more bullish on, like, Tesla and so forth and don't think that Ford is, like, doing enough. But they recently announced a big push with autonomous vehicles. They took over the former Union Station in Detroit and are launching an autonomous vehicle program there. But they've been investing heavily in the SUVs and pickup trucks, which are sold at higher prices, and they pull in much higher profit margins from those. They've been shifting away. They shrunk their U.S. portfolio of sedans considerably and are outsourcing a lot of the sedan production to Mexico and so forth, mm-hmm. and other countries. And they're focusing on the market on the larger vehicles. We've seen an impact on that locally at the Chicago assembly plant. They are, you know, as of next year, sometime early 2019, they're going to stop making the Taurus there for the first time in decades. Taurus sales have been like steadily declining for years and years. It was at one point during the 90s, I believe, like the most the best-selling sedan in America, but they've since, as like Ford has shifted its focus to like the F-Series and everything, they have lost ground to, you know, like the Toyota Camry and the Honda Civic and the Honda, you know, to a lot of the Japanese automakers that are trying to put more of an emphasis on that. And then they will be, so they're focusing kind of on their more profitable vehicles, and the Aviator will be made in Hagwisch to replace the Taurus, but their bread and butter there anyway is the Ford Explorer, yeah. and the Police Interceptor SUVs are strong, remain, you know, top-selling vehicles.
Well, Joe, we have a couple minutes left here. Let's finish up here by talking about BP, how they seem to have done here in the second quarter and the impact that their business is, of course, having on our big refinery in Whiting.
Yes. We may have noticed like we're paying around $3 again for gasoline now, unfortunately, at the pumps. And crude oil prices are up, and that benefits BP greatly. They've been, you know, they've been struggling for a little bit because they had the deep water. They've had all the costs of cleaning up the Gulf of Mexico after the deep water spill, but they had a very good second quarter, $2.8 billion in global revenue. They made, after the deep water thing and when the crude oil prices crashed, they made cuts like worldwide, particularly to their oil exploration. And they made it a leaner, kind of stronger company, and now they're beginning to reap the benefits of that as the market shifts. And, you know, crude oil prices are climbing again. They had a record amount of crude oil processed over at the BP Whiting refinery. It was and it really helped drive their profits globally. They pulled in a $2.8 billion. And they are continuing to. They foresee a future though, where they're not going to be as. They are currently mainly an oil company, but they've been investing like heavily in alternate fuels and technology. Like they bought Britain's largest electric vehicle charging company, battery. They've invested heavily in a battery technology firm, StoreDot. That's one. Battery technology is considered essential for making, you know, solar and wind and a lot of those, you know, other forms of alternate energy more viable in the future. Those have been like extremely fast growing. They're growing off of a smaller base, but they've been posting you know, significant amount of growth. But BP does continue to invest in Whiting. They're in the process of building a new hydrotreater unit that's several $100 million worth of investment, hundreds of construction jobs. In this case, it is mandated by the EPA. They're doing it because they need to make reduce the emissions there and make cleaner fuel. But it is a substantial investment that they're making in the Whiting refinery. I think this might be the second quarter in a row they've achieved record output there, which just shows that big investment they did a couple of years ago to modernize it and take more crude is starting to really pay off for the company.
Well, Joe, we're going to revisit BP and some of the other businesses in Northwest Indiana when we talk with you again next time. Joe Pete is the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, thanks for being with us today here on the program.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking. Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson's Chief of Staff, Brendan Clifton, made a trip from Indianapolis to Crown Point yesterday to deliver the Lake County Precinct Consolidation Plan that lawmakers had mandated her, Mrs. Lawson, to have done by August 1st. And we had a chance to speak for a few minutes with Brendan Clifton, finding out more about this plan that is calling for eliminating precincts with fewer than 600 active voters. Talk us through some of the details, if you can, of what this precinct consolidation plan that's been turned over to the Lake County officials really looks like.
If I could take a step back and just acknowledge the amount of work that has gone into this plan over the last month. We've had about 30 days to get this work done, which really meant that we were in a position to confirm, correct, and validate what we received in the suggested plan at the beginning of July. So there has been a significant amount of effort, research, which has been data-driven, and of course, receiving feedback from various stakeholders and constituent groups. But at the end of the day, we started with 523 precincts that were identified. And out of that 523, there will be 170 consolidations, leaving 353 precincts in the county. There are no changes in the demographics of the precinct consolidations because those occur within the city, the town, or the township. So the demographics and the minority representations remain consistent through this consolidation.
Is there any way in the plan that offers up some suggestions or ideas to Lake County officials as to how they get to implement this in 2019?
Well, the secretary's mandate was to issue the order according to a few factors. One being we're looking at active voters, precincts with fewer than 600 active voters as of November 1st, 2017. And then, in addition, whether we examine the adjacent precincts, of course, the existing township boundaries and the city boundaries, and then the potential for savings as well. So we have identified those consolidations and filed those and defer to the locals on best implementation steps. But we certainly are available to offer any insight if it is requested.
In going through all the information that you had in helping put together the plan, did you find there were any real challenges? We know we're talking about three big communities. We're talking about Hammond and Gary and East Chicago. Were there more challenges in working, say, for example, on way to consolidate precincts within Gary? Because the way that Gary is now situated with population-wise, it's all spread out.
Indeed. So, again, we worked within the existing municipality boundaries. And I think the consolidations in those major areas and in those cities is pretty consistent across the board. Crown Point, for example, we started with 30 precincts, and then the number of precincts after consolidation is 22. So there were 8 total consolidations in Crown Point. Gary, for example, we started with 105, and the number of precincts after consolidation are 51. And then Hammond, it started with 79, and then after consolidation, that remained 46. I'd like to also take the opportunity to highlight the legislative motivation behind this, and I think this has occurred over a couple of years and outside the presence of the secretary, nor was it necessary. It's about efficiency, and it's about using those limited resources in the most efficient manner possible. So this plan, as it was suggested, identifies about $117,000 per year and up to over $700,000 over a four-year election cycle, assuming, of course, that there are six elections in that cycle. And the potential for savings is even greater if there are special elections in that cycle. So there's a substantial savings that's afforded to Lake County voters and residents here in this plan.
Well, now that you've gotten the precinct consolidation plan finished and you've turned it over to Michelle Fehman, who's the director of the Board of Elections and Voter Registration, I guess it's a relief. And now I guess basically it's all on her and her staff's shoulders to go through this. And they have probably plenty of time once we get the November 6th election out of the way to be able to start getting things ready to implement all this next year.
Right, and you're exactly right. This plan is not effective until January 1st of 2019. So voters should not look to this plan as affecting the location in which they're going to vote in November. This is 2019, January 2019 going forward. Members of the public should review this plan. They should have the opportunity to see it, just as the elected officials have on the Secretary of State's website, www.sos.in.gov. Will be all of the orders, the attachments, the maps, the suggested plan. And in addition, we're currently working and discussing the best path forward to educate the folks here in Lake County, which may include a couple of different options. But we've been working for 30 days on this thing, and it has been a substantial and a significant effort. And we're just now shifting gears on the outreach front.
That's Deputy Indiana Secretary of State Brandon Clifton. Lake County Democratic Party Chairman Jim Weiser has denounced the plan as an effort by the Republican-controlled legislature and state government to suppress voting in Democratic Party strongholds, which are, of course, in North Lake County. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and our thanks to our reporters for joining us as well, Carol Carlson and Greg Tejeda from the Post-Tribune and Joseph Pete from the Times of Northwest Indiana. And thank you again, and we hope that you'll be with us on Monday.